And welcome to NetFriend Presence. I'm Matt DeFrance of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, joined by Nathan Mills, also of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, to talk about the Blues going 2-1 in their opening week. Nathan, that opener against Minnesota, losing 5-0, that was quite a downer for Blues fans coming into the regular season. But they rebound after that big loss and win two games in Canada.
Brutal, man, just brutal. Shut out home opening night. Just, what a letdown. I didn't get to actually watch the game. I listened to the game and, you know, maybe that's the difference, but it didn't feel like the score, you know, the score made it look like a lot worse game than it really was. I felt like the Blues were really in it. You know, I mean, they outshot them, in the course of the game, and they just couldn't convert any, and the Wild converted in an outrageous rate of their shots. So it just, you know, the bounces didn't go their way, you know. Then you hit the road and the bounces do go their way. You get a couple of guys going and all of a sudden it looks like a very different team and a very different season. So I feel good about where they're at, even though it was a pretty rough start.
So you listened to it. How did it sound, the simulcast?
Oh, so I didn't get to – so I did finally get to watch a game last night. And that was great. Noticed some production things, but listening to the game was lovely. That's the first time I've ever actually listened to a radio broadcast of a game. And I really, really enjoyed it. So I hope that some of those issues that I saw last night can get cleaned up and the TV side looks and feels a little smoother, but I think that'll probably come, you know, as the season goes on.
Yeah. Cause I'm sure like a lot of Blues fans are in that boat. I mean, this is a new thing that they're trying this year, the simulcast. Yeah. And, you know, when I'm at home games, I don't really listen to much, but you know, I think it'll be interesting to see how it all, I guess, kind of goes throughout the season and kind of evolves. So, you know, as far as the Blues go, I think, you know, yeah, you're right on the home opener. They did lose 5-0, and the third period was kind of meaningless. It was more of an academic period than anything. But the second period, when they were down 2-0, they had, you know, the first 13 shots on goal in the second period, they look like they're in control. They're about to get a goal and maybe start the comeback. Braden Schenn takes a penalty. Minnesota hits a post. They score on their first shot of the period. It's 3-0, and that was basically it. They added the fourth one in that period, and then the third was kind of just was nothingness. So, you know, that the first period was, there were some bounces that didn't go their way, but
yeah.
It didn't seem like they were going to be blown out 5-0. And the score was probably worse than the way they played. And that tends to be the case when you have scores as lopsided as that. But, you know, Jordan Binnington didn't have a good game. And it was the first time the Blues were shut out in a season opener. So there were concerning things. And, you know, after the game, they all said the right things. They all said, hey, you know, it's just one game. We obviously have things to work on. And you know what? This is what Justin Falk said. He said, if we had won the game, we'd still have things to work on. I'd be telling you the same thing. So they had you know, the right mindset after a pretty big season opening loss. And when I was kind of reviewing that loss, I was looking at, okay, what are some of the other teams recently that have lost by this much in a season opener? You know, who's lost by 5+ in a season opener, and how's that season gone? And I looked at it, and it was last year's Oilers went to the Cup final. 2 years ago, those Oilers went to the Cup final. There was the 18-19 Bruins, who famously lost to the Blues in the Cup final. So those were three of the most recent five teams that lost their opener by 5 or more goals. And not saying that you want to do that, right? Like, you don't want to lose your opener by 5+, but it's not like the season's obviously doomed, or it's kind of a precursor to what's to come for the rest of the season. So when I kind of watch how the Blues were actually able to play versus the score, what the attitude was after the game, kind of the history of blowout losses and season openers, like all of the things pointed to a bounce back, and then they delivered it on the weekend.
Man, I thought for sure when you started that list of teams who have done this, it was going to be very good. A bunch of like cup winners, playoff teams, or very bad. It was going to be like, oh, it's the Chicago Blackhawks every year forever.
Well, it was like last year they had two big blowouts. They got got crushed in Ottawa, and then they got crushed at home against Washington. I think it was like an 8-0 loss to Washington, and it was probably like a 7-1 or 8-1 loss in Ottawa, something like that. And I did research at that time, you know, what are the history of teams that have lost, you know, two games by seven within the first month of the season, month and a half, whatever that ended up being. And that list was, that was an ugly list. That was an ugly list. I remember that. And so, you know, looking back at that, it's funny to think about, because that team was so much different than the team that ended up being at the end, right? Like, they changed coaches. They got Cam Fowler. Zach Bolduc got a regular spot in the lineup. Jimmy Snuggerud came up at the season's end. Like, there was a lot of in-season changes that happened with that Blues team that kind of led them to where they finished. And, you know, when we talk about this Blues team, I don't see a lot of in-season changes. I mean, they do have the capability to, because they have a lot of cap space with Torrey Krug set to go on LTIR. So they would have a lot of cap space to do something, but it's not like it's going to be, you know, firing a coach and trading for a top pair D-man, and, you know, Dylan Holloway becoming a point per game player after coaching change, Zach Bolduc becoming someone on the power play, getting a top prospect from college. Like, there's so many changes during the season that led them back. And, you know, this season, I think it's going to be more of the group that we began with, maybe different combinations of it, but more of that group that I think we saw in this first week.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to your point about the differences between the team that began last season and ended last season, you know, I think you see more of that kind of carry over here, right, in these first three games. You know, Montgomery brings a certain type of leadership and a certain type of, you know, approach to hockey, right, that is going to warrant some of the changes that have to happen after a loss like we saw in the opener. And sure enough, there were some changes between the first game and then the second and third games, and they started to come alive. Guys like Neighbors and Snuggerud both get going after seeing lines get shuffled just a little bit. Texier moving up a little bit to handle, you know, some of the offensive zone there. You know, I think that is indicative of the changes that we saw in the second half of last season, and now we're seeing them carry over into this season. Does it mean this is a 96-point win team again? I don't know. You know, that remains to be seen, but I think the potential is definitely there, and they seem to be responding to adversity and to Montgomery's tweaks in the face of adversity the same way they did last season, which I think is, you know, a good sign.
Yeah, so on those tweets, so they began the season top line, Buchnevich, Thomas, Snuggerud, third line, Neighbors, Suter, Joseph, right? And by mid-game of that Minnesota opener, you know, Snuggerud was on the third line with Suter and Walker, actually. And then, you know, Neighbors went up to play with Buchnevich and Thomas, and they finished the game that way. And then in Calgary, they started back again with the previous lines. And then also in Calgary, they switched. So, you know, the first two games, Neighbors ended up with Thomas and Buchnevich up there, and Snuggerud ended up with Suter. And so in Vancouver, they just decided to begin that way. And so, you know, Jake Neighbors has played a lot with Thomas and Buchnevich over the years. They had a good chunk of time together last year when the Blues really kind of decided on their lineup in the second half. They kind of went on that run. It was Neighbors with Thomas and Buchnevich, and then they had Holloway and Shen and Kyrou together. Like, they found their trios, so to speak. And so, you know, Jake Neighbors is someone who can go up and down the lineup. He can fit with guys like Thomas and Buchnevich. He can be physical. We saw him play with Brian Shen in the preseason, and we'll see that at some point again this year. He can play on the third line with Suter. Like, there are different roles that he can fit, and moving him around is kind of what he's kind of done throughout his entire career. I remember a few years ago, he started the season on the fourth line and ended it on the top line. So he's has that capability to do that.
Yeah, and I'm going to put this in professional wrestling terms because I'm a nerd. But he reminds me of like a Shawn Michaels type, where like he's got chemistry with everybody, right? Like he's not going to go in there and put up a dud. You know, is he? He's not Robert Thomas, and he's not trying to be, right? But you can put him on any line in any position, and he's going to slide right in there and do his job and look pretty good. And having a couple of guys like that can go a long way, and especially one like Neighbors, who looks like he's pretty high end for it. You know, I love it. I like that guy quite a bit.
Yeah, I'll be honest. Speaking wrestling is like a different language to me, so that was lost on me.
That's terrible. We got to get Daniel Guerrero and Lynn Worthy on the podcast to talk wrestling. We need a wrestling podcast.
All right. Yeah, I mean, with Neighbors, you know, he brings in elements of physicality, of a net front presence, so to speak, right? I mean, he has that. Yeah. He has that in his game where he goes to the net front. He's able to, he stores a lot of his goals from that area. You know, like that's where goals are stored and that's where his goals are stored. So when you look at Thomas and Buchnevich, like they don't have those elements, or, you know, Suter a little bit more, you know, Joseph sometimes, you know, like there are, he brings it consistently all the time, those elements, and it's not always something that, you know, the Blues bring. So, you know, I did think it was, you know, interesting that when I looked at the, you know, time on ice numbers from Calgary, like Jimmy Snuderud was down. Obviously, he got moved from the first line down, and then they keep him there to start in Vancouver. And, you know, he had a great game in Vancouver against Canucks, scored two goals, his first multi-goal game of his NHL career. So, you know, I don't know what the long-term fit like this season is with Snuderud, if it is with Pugh Suter, and I guess it was Matthew Joseph on that line last night, Joseph Suter and Snutter. So I don't know if the fit is long-term there on that line, or if they keep trying to move him up and down as games go, but he responded with a really good game last night.
Do you see those kinds of moves for him as a young player as, you know, messages? Like, I don't want to say demotion, right? Because like a lot of times, especially with the Blues, the third line will play better than the first line, you know, for spurts, right? But like when you're taken off of that larger responsibility and sort of demoted, I guess, to use a not great phrase, do you think that's a message to a guy who's, you know, in his early 20s and maybe hasn't figured it all out yet? Hey, kid, we need a little more of this. Figure it out.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a message, but like, you know, they lost 5-0. That top line didn't really create a ton. And then they fall behind in Calgary. So, like, when you're looking at it and you go four periods without scoring a goal and you're trying to make changes, it's just part of, you know, being a hockey player. You're going to have line changes. You're going to move up and down. You're going to have different centers. You're going to have different wingers. Like, I think it's more so that than, you know, message sending to a rookie who has played 10 games, is it now? I don't even know how many games he's played, but I think it's, you know, 7 last year, 3 this year. So if my math adds up, 7, meet your fingers, that's 10.
Just to do math now.
Yeah, so, yeah, I don't think it's so much message sending as trying to find a right fit that works for the lineup. And I think it also has to do with Jake Neighbors. I mean, that's what Montgomery's talked about before, that he wanted to reward Jake Neighbors for the game that he was having. And so if you reward someone, you got to move someone else out. So yeah, that's kind of the give and take there and cause and effect. But Snuderud, I mean, he found his way around the puck last night. He had a lot of shots on goal. Obviously, the two goals, and, you know, those were right around the net front. One, he was kind of a turnaround shot.
Oh, yeah, that first goal was beautiful. Yeah. Yeah,
really tough to kind of gather and pick a corner in that moment. And then the second one, everyone on the Blues power play touched the puck within, you know, 3 seconds, but it wasn't the traditional tit-tac-toe passing. You know, it's a chipped dump in and a hard forecheck causing a turnover. Buchnevich, it looked like he was going to shoot the puck, maybe whiffed on it a little bit, and it finds its way to Snuderud, who can roof it. So, you know, things, you know, went well to put him in the right spots, but he also had to be in the right spots and you know, have the poise to finish those. So a great game by Jimmy Snuderud. And, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of Calder Trophy hype in Montreal for guy Ivan Demidov, you know, top draft pick a few years ago, you know, came over. He's got the Montreal hype train behind him, and they have the reigning Calder Trophy winner in Lane Hudson. And so, you know, rookie of the year, it is up for grabs, I think. And Jimmy Snuggerud has a case if he can continue to get the opportunities that he has had, both on, you know, the first power play unit and at even strength. So if he can kind of produce more early, I think in particular, get on the national radar and kind of stay in that Calder Trophy conversation, there can be a real campaign through later in the season.
He's got great instincts for it. I mean, that's one of the things that I've noticed about him just in the 10 games, to your point, is that he seems to kind of, he's one of those guys who doesn't just know where the puck is, he knows where it's going to be. And that's where he's going to be. And that was that first goal last night, where he kind of had that sort of half turned around backhand sort of thing he did. That's exactly what it was. He had come across, made a pass, saw it moving across, and there he was right in front of the net again. So yeah, I think he can keep it up. I hope he can keep it up. You know, you don't want to maybe put money on a Calder Trophy win yet, right? But I would love to see that. A Blues Rookie of the Year, give it to me.
Yeah, and let's talk a little about goaltending. So Jordan Binnington and Joel Hofer, the Blues goaltending tandem for the third straight year, to pairing that we've seen pretty consistently. I mean, I don't even think there's been a third guy that's gotten in a game the last 2 years, and they've split it fairly consistently across the last 2 years. This year might be a little bit different. I mean, Montgomery mentioned it last night, that you might not see the same 55-28 split that we've seen the last 2 years, or 55-27. There you go. They're asking.
See, asking, I told you, don't ask to do math.
Yeah, that's right. 82 is a much harder number than 10, I guess. So they have a more condensed schedule because of the Olympics. Obviously, Jordan Binnington is going to have the Olympics as well. He's going to be playing in them in all likelihood for Team Canada. So they might be relying more on a tandem than they had previously. And last year and the year before, it was about 2/3, 1/3. And especially when Jim Montgomery took over, it was almost, to a fault. Binnington, Hofer, until the very end of the season, when they were trying to clinch a playoff spot and they wanted their number one in net. So maybe this year looks more, like it did in this opening week with Binnington, Hofer, Binnington, and then maybe they go Binnington, Hofer, Binnington. Like it should look a little different this year than it did previously, I think.
Yeah, so the Blues' greatest strength has for a little while now been their goaltenders, right? And I think we saw some of the benefit of that, right? I mean, Binnington, to your point earlier, looked kind of terrible, honestly, in the first game. Didn't look like himself. Hofer bounces back with a good game against Calgary. And then last night, I wish I could remember who they said it was during the broadcast, but one of the Blues players says that Binnington, you can tell when he's on because of how smooth he looks out there on the ice, just how easy he makes everything look. And he looked that way last night, so he was ready to rock and roll. Having Hofer get some more time here early so you feel – he's a 1B right now, maybe, rather than a 2, right? Maybe you want to get him a little closer to a 1A, knowing that Binnington's got some other responsibilities coming on. But I felt good about him in the first 3 games. I felt good about him for years. I'll tell you again, I do miss Colton Ellis already. But, I don't know what more there is to say about Binnington that hasn't been said. But Hofer, I would love to see a lot more of him. I'm very intrigued by what he can be.
When I think about the Blues goaltending in recent years, it's kind of unfortunate the timing of their good years, to be quite honest. Yep. I mean, they were elite maybe the best tandem in the league 2 years ago when Jordan Binnington was, yeah, I think I had him as, you know, the media, the PHWA votes for the all-star team, all-star teams at the end of the year. I think I had him third on my goaltending ballot. And I was stunned that he didn't receive like really any sort of Vezina votes from the general managers. I was floored by that, to be quite honest, because he was, by all advanced metrics, one of the best goaltenders in the league. Joel Hofer in that year was his rookie year. I think I had him first on my all rookie voting. I think Peter Kachetkov in Carolina ended up winning that spot. But the point was they were two of the best in the league. And then last year, a little more inconsistent. Maybe took a little bit of a step back. I mean, you know, Binnington goes from 913 to 900. You know, that's a sizable step back. It's still around league average, but when you have someone of his caliber that you want to be feeding starts, you want maybe a little bit better than that. You know, Hofer takes a step back from 913 to 904. So they both take, you know, a little bit backwards last year, and that's when the team got really good. So you had them being really elite, top of the lead, almost the best tandem in the lead, probably. I mean, if that year you probably could have said, you know, Winnipeg and whoever, you know, Hellebuck, and it didn't really matter whose backup was, they were still going to be the best tandem in the league. But you had them being really, really good when the team in front of them was maybe not there. And then last year they took a little bit of a step back when the team in front of them finally did get there. And I wonder what it's going to look like this year. Do those two finally match up? Do they kind of, are they both good at the same time? And I wonder how that looks in the end.
Well, with any luck, it looks like it does. Looks like it did last night. Looks like it did Saturday in Calgary. You know, I mean, I thought both of them looked pretty good. You know, not so much Binnington, obviously, in the first game, but I thought both of them looked good on the road. Poised, you know, both allowed a couple of goals, but it's nothing egregious. The only one that from Binnington last night that I, you know, just what he was just beat was that second goal on the breakaway, you know, and that happens. Is I can't fault the guy for that. So, you know, I hope that it looks more like that, but I do think you're right. Taking that step back with Binnington having other, you know, other things going on, let's say, and then of course age, you know, will be start to be a factor for him at some point. Maybe relying on Hofer more isn't such a bad thing.
Yeah, and coming up on the NetFront next, we have Jim Thomas, former Post-Dispatch beat writer for the Blues and the Rams. He has a new book coming out on the Blues, and him and I talked about the book, his retirement plans, which really haven't been much of a retirement, and more about Blues history, about his outlook on the current team, and share some stories about that 19 team that I'm sure many of you guys are really invested in. From I guess 6 years ago now. So that was Nathan. I'm Matt. Stay tuned for the interview with Jim Thomas. And we'd like to welcome Jim Thomas back to the NetFront. JT, a longtime member of the NetFront Presence podcast. Welcome back, JT.
It's great to be back, Matthew. How are you? I know why you want me on. You want to talk about Leo Loof, don't you? So
that's it. I mean, I was watching Springfield the other night, and I was watching Leo Loof play. And I was like, man, JT would probably be disappointed in how he's looking on the ice right now.
You know, and I know you and Jeff would make fun of my seeming obsession with Leo Loof, but it was only because, and I won't mention his name, a personnel guy used to constantly rave about him when talking to me. So I really thought he would be on the team. Maybe I got a hint. It was one of my last press deals before I retired when I asked Armstrong about Leo Loof. I don't know if you remember this. It was out at Centene. And what did Armstrong say? Boy, you're really reaching down on the depth chart for this one. So I thought, oh, wow, poor Leo.
Well, JT, what I remember about that last press conference you had out at Centene, like the season end, was I think you asked about Tyson Galloway too, because I think his rights were going to expire or something.
I don't think I asked about Tyson Galloway.
No, okay, maybe that was something different. But yeah, JT, welcome back. I would say you've been you've been retired in a way, but you've been keeping busy, huh? You had your radio show, you got your blues book, you got your Mike Martz book. Just tell us what you've been up to.
Well, we're not doing it this year, but we did it was a radio show / podcast with Mike Martz on football. Last year was just a podcast. And in the meantime, I'm working on a Mike Martz book. So between that and between, I know this time of year, there'd be a lot of promotion stuff for me to do for the blues book. We just put we put the podcast on hiatus for a year. We're going to try to do it again. It was a lot of fun with Mike, but yeah, retirement's been pretty good. It seems like I'm keeping busy, but it's not like the grind of covering a hockey team. I can assure you that, Matthew, and you know, I'm seeing a lot of the family. I actually say hi to the neighbors now instead of rushing out to get out to the rink for the morning skate or whatever. Although I had a neighbor, the dear man passed away not too long ago. He would have an uncanny ability of knowing exactly when I'd leave the house. Joe Davis was his name, and he would give me some advice to tell first Mike Martz and the Rams, and then Craig Berube and the Blues. He used to work for Tums, and one time when things were going really bad for the Rams, he gave me a jar of Tums, you know, they're like antacids or whatever, to give to Mike Martz. And I actually presented it to Mike, and he thought it was pretty funny. But no, it's been good. I've probably seen more of my family in these 2 years than I did probably in the 10 years between. Believe it or not, I go to a gym regularly. I walk the dogs. It's different. It's kind of a regular thing. You know what a rat race it is as a beat writer, especially on the hockey beat. As we were kidding before we started this, there's no easy way to get to Winnipeg and back. So travel is crazy.
What I love about retired sports writers is like the retired part is generally a lie. I don't think I've ever seen a sports writer retire and then stop writing. I don't think I've ever seen it, JT.
Well, I haven't done any free other than the book, so that's guy. Sure, I get yeah. that, but and I tweet a little bit on the Blues, but I love all the bad Rams games I saw. The Greatest Show was great, but it was like a meteor. It flashed in the sky really quick, like 4 years it was done. So I saw a lot of bad football. Often, as I'm hoping the clock runs down in the second half, I would look in the stands or see pictures of fans on the Jumbotron, and they're laughing, they're having a beer and saying, wow, boy, that looks like fun. It would be nice to be on the other side. Well, that's one thing I've been doing a lot of since I retired, kind of becoming a fan. I went to about six Blues games last year as a fan, about every Lindenwood hockey home series. They're two game, usually Friday, Saturday. About every home series, I go to one of their games. I've been to almost, not all, but almost all Battlehawks games. I've been to a few Billikens games. It's a lot of fun. And usually, you know, have a friend or one of my sons to go there with. So it's been a good time that way.
Yeah, it's fun because like, I don't think people realize when you become a sports writer, you kind of lose a lot of fandom, if not all of it. Like for me, I got one team I root for, and that's Notre Dame football. And I guess it would, even before, it was Army football for you before retirement, right? But yeah, outside of that, like you're either working and you don't have a fandom there, or you just like lose touch of the other, for me, like the Miami sports teams, because I move around and get so busy. Like it just, you lose it all. And that must be fun to have it back, to be quite honest.
yeah, no, you're exactly right. And you know, it's not like we're working on a construction site or doing brain surgery, but it is a grind what we do. Yeah. And a lot of hours as a beat writer, the travel can be brutal in hockey. Again, it's not a 162 game season like baseball, but when you're covering a baseball team, usually you're in the town like for three games, 4 days. It's not the case with the hockey and the faraway locales. You know, as a kid and even earlier in my career, I didn't do a lot of other than on the beat traveling. So it was great just to make the Canadian trips and to get up to Montreal and Toronto and the Western Canada and, you know, a little time to walk around maybe after the morning skate or get a dinner. You still enjoy that part of it, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I think I've been to all of the arenas in the league now, and like just seeing all the different arenas, different cities, different landmarks. Like even, I think when you mentioned Western Canada, there were times where there'd be an off day in Calgary, you'd go rent a car, you had to drive to Banff. You know, there'd be an off day in Vancouver, you'd go over to Victoria, or you'd pop up to Whistler and just like see kind of nature, honestly. Like,
yeah,
you know, yeah, it was a good time. But as far as right now, JT, you have a book called The Franchise, St. Louis Blues, just came out. Can you just tell us why you wanted to report this book, why you wanted to write this book? There it is.
The timing is pretty bizarre, Matthew. It was April of 2023, only maybe a week before it was near the end of the season. The Blues didn't make the playoffs that year, as you were aware. You were on the scene by then. And I was approached by Triumph Books, a regional publishing firm out of Chicago, about doing the book. And I'm thinking, well, Matthew, Jeremy, and Lou must have turned them down if they're coming to me. But here's the thing. When you're retired, you have time to do this stuff. I would never want to do a book while you're covering the beat, because when I would get my downtime, I would want to just unplug it, you know, recharge, get away from what it, whether it be the Rams or the Blues. And you know how it is. So, but a little, I can't fathom working on a book while you're in the middle of covering a team during the season. So being retired was a good thing. They approached me, and I figured out, and it was a lot of research, maybe about $10 an hour I made on this project. Now, there's certain ways I can make money on selling the book. That's why lately, Matt, I've been like an encyclopedia salesman, going to all these sports bars and independent bookstores, trying to set up book signings and whatnot. Again, Triumph is a regional firm, so they're doing some promoting, but it's not like they have a lavish so a lot of the promotion has fallen on me. But it was a lot of fun to write. I especially like the kind of the history part. Again, it's been a strange project, because the original manuscript was sent in about a week. I want to say a week before Thanksgiving in 2024. It was supposed to come out a year ago. And Thanksgiving of 2023. It was supposed to come out early in 2024.
Oh, wow.
They had some budget cutbacks and whatnot. So, you know, it's a timeless book because it's a history. It wouldn't get dated. So they delayed it by a year, but it's so now it's finally out. But I had to update it several times. You know how it works. You may have a sentence in there. It was the 10th time in 11 years the Blues had made the playoffs. Well, you have to update that because a whole season has passed.
You had to have to add the chapter about the offer sheets, right?
About the what?
The offer sheets.
yeah, really. No, that didn't make the cut. The other thing is, one of the best chapters to write, I wrote a chapter on the Kellys, Dan and then John, and turning the manuscript right around, I think, early May of this year. And that was before John was let go. But it was a fun thing to write. So if you're wondering, why does he mention John that's is no longer with the Blues? That's why, because it was turned in May. But I'm glad it's here. It was fun to do. The history part was good. I really, like I said, I enjoyed doing some of the early parts. And it's like 80,000 words, so it's a, you know, it's not like a coffee table book, but I tried to concentrate. There's like three or four chapters on hockey in St. Louis before the Blues, getting the Blues, and then those first three seasons where, as a member of the second six, they were in the Cup Finals. Really the town, and I was a teenager then, it just became smitten by the Blues. And then there might be five chapters on the Stanley Cup, the summer where they got O'Reilly and Perron and Bozak and the terrible start that they had in the season, then the rally, and then the playoffs, and then the aftermath of winning the Stanley Cup. So I concentrated a lot on those eras, but we cover a lot of extra ground. There's like four or five chapters on some of the coaching greats with the Blues. There's like four or five on some of the player, the great players in Blues histories. And there's about four or five chapters also kind of just traumatic moments or dramatic moments with the Blues, like the Monday Night Miracle and Doug Wickenheiser, the team almost moving to Saskatoon, stuff like that. And it's a mixture. I did a lot of research, looked up a lot of stuff in the archives, dating all the way back to the St. Louis Star Times showed up, an old St. Louis newspaper. The Globe Democrat people, they're going to be mad at me because there's no references to the Globe, but our Post-Dispatch archives, Matthew, didn't have any Globe Democrat stuff. They had St. Louis Star Times, but no. So George Solak, if you're watching this, or if you will be watching this, I apologize. So a lot of archive work. And you probably remember, you're with the Dallas Stars during COVID. We were struggling for stuff to write because there were no live events. We did this Where Are They Now thing with the Blues, and I called up a lot of old Blues just out of the blue. Gary Unger, Gary Sabourin, Frank St. Marseille, a lot of leftover stuff from that. Gary Unger, when I did his thing, I couldn't get him off the phone. It was like an hour and 10 minutes. And I'm thinking,
and that
I
was
could
before
write a
the Hall of Fame, before the Blues Hall of Fame came into existence.
Well, and that thing lasted forever with Gary. So a lot of stuff left over from there. But I did some of my own like unique interviews too, exclusively for the book, including Armstrong. And one of the most fun interviews was with Gary Miller, one of our former Blues beat writers. He's been retired for a while and lives up in the Chicago area, but he was the beat writer during the infamous brawl, and we have a chapter on that, with the Philadelphia Flyers in 1972. Somehow he convinced the authorities, and Sid Solomon, then owner, had no problem with that, he was like a Blues executive. So he got to walk in the locker room when all the players were arrested. He got to go to the jail that night after the game. They had jailed like four Blues players. And finally, he got to go in the courtroom, and they didn't let any other media in there because they thought he was like a Blues executive. Finally, he got, I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but a Philadelphia beat writer recognized GM, as we call him, Gary Miller, and said, and so Gary agreed to share any information he got from inside the courtroom as long as he wasn't outed by the Philadelphia writer. So that's right. We're a fraternity, right? Beat writers sticking together. So,
yeah, I mean, I was wondering, I mean, you kind of mentioned it there, but, you know, when I look at the history of the Blues, I wonder the different styles of reporting through the different eras, right? Like you, as you mentioned, you went through the archives. Did you have to go to the library at all? You said you did your own reporting, and a lot of this you actually lived too. Like even when you weren't covering the Blues before, you were still, you know, in St. Louis, you're still around. And then when you were covering them for the biggest moment in franchise history. So how did you try to kind of weave all that together between, you know, reading the history archives, your own experience, and then the new reporting for the book in its own?
Well, what I tried to do too is weave in, because you mentioned I was alive during all of it. Now, when you're covering a beat, as you kind of alluded to earlier, you kind of lose track of your fandom, or whatever or interest. You just don't have time. But I tried to weave in personal experiences, like when the Blues were here in the late '60s and took the town by storm. I was a teenager, and I remember all of a sudden people who didn't know what a hockey stick was, we're playing street hockey. And I can remember in my neighborhood in South City in St. Louis, I can remember being out there playing in the streets. Okay, car coming down the street, timeout, you know, and all that. I can remember, you know, Gary Unger might've been the first in all of St. Louis sports, might've been the first matinee idol. He came in, he had the flowing blonde hair, which was, unusual. I remember going to a game and the weather was pleasant. So it might have been either early in the season or maybe late in the season when the weather gets better. We knew where the players came out, and I can remember. And this is in the book. We're waiting. Unger comes out and he very politely declined to do autographs, but it was like you would imagine it with Gary Unger. He had a beautiful blonde on his arm, his long flowing blonde locks himself. he hops into a sports car and drives off into the night. I mean, he, like I said, he was like the first matinee idol of Saint. So I tried to weave some of that in, personal experience, stuff behind the scenes, you know, stuff that we see as the beat writer, which is why it's so important to be on the scene. My dad had a saying that don't break your arm patting yourself on the back, but I don't know if anybody would know about Gloria if the Post-Dispatch hadn't made the commitment to go to all the games. And I was in Florida right at the start of their hot streak. What was it? The 11 game winning streak that propelled them into the playoff there in the 2018-19 season. I go in the locker room, they rally to in the third period, a comeback win over Florida. And they're playing Gloria. And I go up to Vince Dunn. I said, Vince, you have a big win on the road and you're playing disco music. Now, I know disco purists will say, technically, when that song came out, it's kind of right when disco was ending in what was called dance music of the early 80s. I know this because I was a little bit of a lounge lizard back then.
Disco purists are going to come for you, JT.
What's that?
The disco purists are going to come for you.
Yeah, they are. They might be all after. So anyway, maybe that's never discovered. Now, I wrote about it that day, but I hardly mentioned other. I know Jeremy did a big story. Chris Pinkard, who does such a great job with the blues social media, he did a lot with it. But maybe it doesn't even come out because we were the only visiting media there, the whole Gloria thing. And another thing I remember on the road is in Columbus, this was might have been victory number two in the 11-game streak. Ran in, as you know, on the road, sometimes we run into the players in the at the team hotel or whatever, and Binnington coming out, and he was asking me for advice on media relations, because Binnington, right from the start, he gave these very two-word answers, like he was bothered by us. It was all an act, and he said, Jim, you know, I can give longer answers if you want, and I said, you know, you do what you want, but what you're doing with these clipped kind of blunt answers, it's kind of funny. So if you want to keep doing it. And he kept doing it. And then I unwittingly later became the straight man with the, are you nervous question, and him saying, do you look nervous? So all that I weaved in, and also historically, there was stuff. I remember the 67-68 season. They actually canceled playoff games because of the Martin Luther King assassination. They postponed two playoff games. So I tried to also weave it in with the times, what was going on with some of the other sports teams. It's amazing when you think of it in that 67-68 season, St. Louis had an NFL team, the Cardinals. The Blues were an expansion team. There was a outdoor soccer league called NASL, North American Soccer League, a precursor to MLS. They had the St. Louis Stars, which were an expansion team. The Hawks were still here in the NBA, and of course, you had Cardinal baseball. So we had one of everything. Then now, you know, we're down to a three-sport town with the soccer, the hockey, and the baseball.
Yeah, and throughout all of your research, all of your interviews, what were some of the things that surprised you about Blues history? Because, I mean, you come in with a pretty good knowledge base to begin with, but I'm sure you uncovered some things that you're like, well, I didn't know this part. What were some of those things?
Well, first off, let me just a quick aside. This franchise, it's like a series by Triumph, and like there, and they do it for certain sports franchises in North America. For example, there's a franchise book on the Red Sox, a franchise book on the Yankees. In hockey, right, there's, it just came out this year, a franchise book on the Red Wings. When they wanted to do one on the Blues, I think St. Louis fans should take it as a compliment, you know, as to what they thought of St. Louis as a hockey brand, the Blues as a hockey brand, and St. Louis as a hockey market, that they wanted to do one on the Blues. But some of the early history stuff just totally floored me. I had no idea that St. Louis had an NHL team in 1934-35, just for one season. The Ottawa Senators folded. They played one year in St. Louis. They lost a lot of money, and that was it.
Was that the and Eagles?
The Ottawa Senators didn't get a team back until, when did the current version, was it in the
92? Yeah, 92 or something like that.
Early 2000s, 90s maybe.
Yeah.
And actually, you can go online and they were called the St. Louis Eagles. And the front, it's the actual eagle. It's the likeness from the Anheuser-Busch advertising. It's the exact same thing. And I bought jerseys, what was it, last Christmas, for each of my sons, Thomas 1, 2, and 3, first son, second born, third born. And some of the book signings I might borrow one of my sons and wear it, the old Eagles. It's pretty cool. But also learning that the Blues were only the third NHL team to play home games in St. Louis. Besides the 1 year of the Eagles, the Chicago Blackhawks actually in the 50s, their attendance was so bad, they had missed the playoffs like 11 to 12 years. At that time, the Blackhawks owners own the old arena in St. Louis. And 1 year they played six regular season home games at the arena, the Chicago Blackhawks with Tony Esposito in goal. And the next year they played five games. And the first year the attendance was pretty much on par with what the Blackhawks were drawing in Chicago. The interest died off a little bit the next year. And after that they didn't. So the Blues are like the third, NHL team to play in St. Louis. So there are a lot of fun stuff like that.
It's like a Blackhawks study abroad program. And
how often do we see that? Now, I guess there was a time when Buffalo for a while played some NFL games in Toronto.
And I think sometimes we'll see it more out of necessity. Like when you think about the Pelicans, or the, I think at the time they were the Hornets, going to play in OKC after Katrina. But even like, I think the closest thing we get nowadays are preseason games at neutral sites. And this year, Ottawa, they had it in Quebec City against the Canadiens, and their fans almost lost their minds. I mean, I think it was mostly Canadiens fans in Quebec City for a Senators home game, right? Uh-huh. But it's kind of a similar to think about back in the day when you think about, you know, St. Louis, Chicago being rival cities, and suddenly you have this team playing some games there.
It wouldn't have happened had the whole expansion here, if the Chicago owners said, man, we need to find a way to get rid of this arena, sell it to somebody. So that helped grease the skids that they could sell the arena as St. Louis got a team. And once again, the front runner kind of back then it was Baltimore. So once again, Baltimore, or that was the first example. But when St. Louis got the Rams, when the Rams were leaving L.A., all along it was thought that Baltimore was going to be the spot, and it turned out to be St. Louis. There were some colorful writers back then. You meant the writing style was a lot different. Our first writer was Wally Cross. He actually was a Canadian.
That's a great name. Oh, my goodness. That's a great writer name.
Wally Cross.
Wally Cross.
Was he a goalie? He played junior hockey in Canada. And I swear the name is escaping me now. But when he covered the team, one of Canada's big tough guys at the time, he played against him. And Wally Cross knew a lot about hockey. You know a lot about hockey, much more than I ever knew. I would say you and, of course, Gordo, much longer history, but to have a guy like Wally Cross who knew the league and knew, you know, if you're playing junior hockey in Canada, you're playing at a fairly high level.
Yeah.
But then now, obviously, your depth in hockey, it's a real blessing to have you, and especially with Gardo. You're like, man, you're like the keeper of the torch. What are you, like 22 years old now? You're like the keeper of the flame for hockey in St. Louis. It's a little bit of pressure there, brother.
This is my ninth season covering the NHL right now. So we'll see how long we can keep it going, I guess. But, you know, when we talked about 2019, obviously that's the biggest moment in the franchise's history, winning the first Stanley Cup. You were there for that. You covered the whole season. When you go back and write about that, you know, does it feel weird, fun, nostalgic? Like, what are kind of the feelings you have personally when you go back to start writing about 19?
Well, all of the above, and again, also weaving in some personal, you know, one of the best things we can do is kind of, as beat writers, whenever you can, go behind the curtain, and the demand for tickets at TD Garden was so great, I'm sure, in St. Louis as well. Normally, as you know, Matthew, the scratches or the injured players, they're in a luxury suite. Mm-hmm. Well, all the luxury suites were in use at TD Garden. So all the Blues scratches, and I assume the Bruins too, were right on press row. So right as I sat at TD Garden, like this far from me was Robert Thomas. He had a hand injury, a wrist injury. So he didn't play in game 7. I don't know if he played, trying to remember if he played in any games in that final series. Anyway, so I'm doing my job. As you know, we're writing a running story there on Deadline. And so I'm trying not to bother the players, but when Chen scored to make it 3-0 in the third period, I just glanced over to the players. You could tell just the look on their eyes, the realization, we're going to win this thing. And that St. Louis, after all this time, was finally going to have a Stanley Cup champion. That, to me, of all the memories of that season, that sticks out the most. Just real, it's going to happen. St. Louis is going to have a team, and you know all franchises have weird stuff happen to them. But the Blues have had so much ups and downs, almost, and some of the stuff with Saskatoon, almost moving to Saskatchewan was hilarious. Almost losing a team. Some of the tragedies that they had with the Barclay Plager dying of cancer, the Doug Wickenheiser. The Monday Night Miracle and his death, Gary Unger with Bob Gassoff at the Memorial Day party. Like I said, strange ups and downs. And so it's for them to finally win the cup. People have asked me a lot because, as you know, I covered the 99 Rams, the only St. Louis championship in the NFL, which is better. And people are a little surprised because, you know, really most of my adult career was about like 27 years covering the NFL. Period, right. Leading up to the Rams and also for about a year and a half after they left. But I give a slight edge to the Blues. One, because they were St. Louis born. I mean, we stole the Rams to get, and that we loved them. And although the Rams was a worst to first story, they were the worst NFL team in the entire decade of the 90s when they won. The Blues were in last place in January, in the middle of a season, and then 50 years, all this stuff that happened to the franchise. I give a slight edge to the Blues for what was, in my mind, a more memorable moment. And then the parade was, you know, usually you hear from a million people a famous sporting event. They say, yeah, I was there. I was like, how could you be there? Well, like 500,000 people were there. And I think it was a good estimate for the parade. And I was on the parade route and then couldn't walk. It was just too crowded. Timmerman hopped on one of the fire engines that were going down. And I missed the boat on that. But when people say they were there for the parade, I bet they were, because it was an incredible, incredible crowd. And never forget how drunk Brett Hull was on the stage. But also Ryan O'Reilly's famous line. He's on the stage. He's looking out of this throng into the Gateway Arch. This is after the parade. And he says, I'm paraphrasing and I might mess it up. He says, St. Louis is a town of great hockey fans, fabulous people. And then he pauses and said, and absolutely incredible drinkers. And kids, if you're at home, drink responsibly.
Yeah, let's talk about this year's team. JT, I know you keep up with them. And I think back to when you retired and from the Post-Dispatch, and that was right after the 2022-23 season. So they had just traded away Tarasenko, Mikkola, O'Reilly, Achari, Barbashev at the deadline. They were just starting the reset, retool, reload, whatever. Now here we are about 2.5 years later. Are you yourself surprised at how they've been able to turn it around right now?
That was quite a run last year, kind of reminiscent in some ways of the 99 run. And I had a son that at that time lived in Washington, D.C. I was at a bar with him in D.C. on H Street. We're watching game seven. They're up by two. What is there, like 3 minutes left? And one of his friends, this lady, says, well, I guess the Blues have it now. Knowing the history of the Blues, and now that I'm retired, I can be a fan. I said, don't jinx this. She felt so bad after Winnipeg rallied. Matt, have you ever thought what might have happened had the Blues won that series? I mean, who knows?
Yeah, I did think about it, and I still think Dallas is probably the better team, and they beat Winnipeg that series anyway before they fell apart against Edmonton. So, like, I kind of stopped short of, you know, saying they would have gone on a deeper run, particularly because it wasn't like they were going on the road and winning those games either. You know, that game seven would have been their first road win of the playoffs there. So I didn't think that it would be a long run, but it was an interesting thing to think, like, hey, like, they do get past Winnipeg, who's best team in the regular season. You know, Dallas is there, and, you know, what if they can match up with the Stars?
Matthew, always a cold-eyed realist. You can expect that kind of coverage in the Post-Dispatch and STLtoday.com. But I think what people forget about the aftermath of 2019, and especially hit hard in that last season I was on the beat, COVID just wrecked the Blues more than anything else. They were one of these teams, the top teams, spend to the cap. They try to finesse the cap as much as you can. But other than LTIR, it's much easier to finesse the cap, for example, in the NFL than the NHL. But with a flat cap, basically, for 3 years, maybe they can afford to keep an O'Reilly or a Mikkola or whoever, Perron, if the cap had gone up 4 or 5 million, which is what it was doing then, for like 3 years. Well, I think it went up 1 million one of those years, nothing another one, and maybe 1 million. So that just destroyed. So they, now some of those players may have been gone already, but some of them, you know, have had pretty good traction. O'Reilly's still an effective player. We didn't mention Perron earlier in the players they let go. It looks like maybe he's near the end, but he had two or three really good seasons. Tarasenko has really kind of dried up, but he had a couple good seasons after he left. So maybe they would be able to forestall that drop off, at least to some extent. But in hockey, like other sports, it's so difficult to maintain a level of excellence with the cap and free agency. It's just hard to sustain stuff. So it's amazing when teams like, Tampa Bay is still going pretty strong. The Lightning, obviously, in football, there's the example, the unbelievable example of the Patriots. But it's hard to sustain it. But I am surprised that they've kind of rebounded as quick as they have. I don't think they're a serious cup contender. I'm pretty sure you don't think either. But I think they could be a dangerous team in the playoffs. I think, as you know, I love Bull Duke, and I loved his skill and his instinct as a scorer. So those guys don't grow on trees. So I was kind of disappointed to see him go. And Mayhew is a great prospect, but you know how fans are. It takes longer for defensemen, and now Bull Duke, once he scored a goal in each game, I'm sure Blues fans
are up in arms.
But I like scoring, so I was a little disappointed to see him go. But they have a lot of scoring. And players like, I actually tweeted, I still think Neighbors is a little underappreciated. But on paper, this is like the classic Armstrong team. He likes to get a collection of good to really good players instead of the superstar system. And it's hard to get superstars unless you're, you know, Edmonton had so many draft picks during their down, high draft picks. But, yeah, it's hard to get superstars. But this looks like a Armstrong type of team with a lot of good to really good players. You know, Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl, as good as they are, as much as they drag that team along, they can only be on the ice, what, one out of three shifts? Maybe in the playoffs they're playing them every other shift. Somebody else has got to be on the ice the other time. And that's why I think the depth in scoring that I think the Blues have will help them out. Obviously, it comes down to the goaltending. I really like Hofer. I was a little disappointed in Binnington's performance in the first game, but he'll bounce back. And he's got to be as high. He's one of the most competitive sports athletes I've been around. But he's got to be extra motivated with a chance to be on the Canadian Olympic team coming up. So, again, if you have the good goaltending, you can go a long way. What do you think of the defense? I know it's only a couple of games. What are you seeing out of these guys?
Yeah, I think the third pair has some growing to do with Tucker and Mayhew. Fowler and Parayko, they were on the ice for a breakdown in that opener. You know, I think they've been fine. You know, I think overall, like, they're still missing that number one defenseman. But I think Florida has kind of provided a blueprint for other teams. Like, they don't have a Makar or a Hughes or even a Hedman back there. They kind of had their specialties. They had, you know, Forsling was their shutdown guy, and Ekblad could kind of do a little bit of everything. And, you know, they had offensive guys, you know, Ekman Larson at first and then Nate Schmidt. Like, they had guys in specific roles. They didn't just have that guy that, you know, maybe like Petrangelo was for the Blues and what Hedman was or Makar was, or like, they've kind of made me think about defense scores a little differently. And I think that's kind of where Doug Armstrong is probably looking. If you look at the way the Blues have done their detour, they don't have a number one guy, and they probably don't have one in the pipeline either, and a true number one all around guy. But they do have serviceable guys that can play roles pretty well.
Yeah. And you look at around the league, and Vince Dunn, Nico Mikkola, and by goodness, even Jake Walman. Top four guys. Now, Walman was a late bloomer, but he could always skate. He always had a shot. He was very immature when he was with the Blues, and that led to some issues. But you look, and it's like, man, he got all these top four defensemen with other teams. Now, with Dunn, that was the expansion draft by Seattle, and they exposed Tarasenko. That's when Tarasenko wanted out. They told Seattle, here, take Vladdy Tarasenko. But they took Vince Dunn, who I think has really blossomed there, and Mikkola. You know, that one surprised me a little. They could have got him pretty cheaply, but they're, like I said, partly spurred on by the COVID. They were really in cap hell, the Blues, for a while. And Walman, late bloomer, who could have predicted that? They're making he and Mikkola, they're making some outrageous dough these days, huh?
Yeah, Walman signed for $50 million.
Yeah. Walman used to always, I guess I can kiss and tell now, when I'd see him, even when he was up in Detroit, I did a story, he'd always bug me, especially when it was in the Blues. Why don't you guys write more about me? Why don't you write about how I should be playing and stuff? He spent an inordinate amount of time. I'm sure you ran into Dallas stars like that, reading social media and stuff and giving me feedback on it. If I were an athlete, Matthew, I would be ostrich in the sand. I would not want to read what was being said or written about me. I would leave it to the PR people. If someone's saying something really mean-spirited or nasty, let me know. Otherwise, I don't want to know. Mark Bulger, the successor to Kurt Warner as the Rams quarterback, he used to tell me that. And there's a station here, maybe right about now in St. Louis, that still they start playing Christmas carols 24 hours a day in like late October. He said, when I'm heading to Rams Park or wherever, I turn on the Christmas carols. I don't listen to sports talk or whatever. That's what I would be doing.
Yeah. JT, this is great. Glad to have you back on at the net front. Just tell the people where they can find your book, where they can find you.
Yeah. The book, if you want to order it online, it's on amazon.com. It's on Triumph Books. I think it's like number 93,000. Seriously, on the New York Times bestseller list. So I want to try to maybe get up into the 80s.
Yeah, that's some room to grow.
Yeah, yeah. And, but also, I'm going to do a lot of book signings. I'll be at a lot of craft fairs. I'm actually doing two, I believe, but I'm doing a Blues book signing at Enterprise on Thursday. What would that be? October the 23rd, the Utah Mammoth game. They're going to have me down there on the concourse. The Blues have been gracious enough to do that. And so between the popcorn and the beer stand, you will see me wedged in there. Come on by and say hello. I appreciate spending time with you. I'm sorry I haven't spent any contact with you since I retired, but I'm figuring Matt is like a kid. I have kids older than him. Why would he want to hang out with a 71-year-old? So, but congratulations on the birth of the kid. You're an outstanding hockey writer, very knowledgeable. We're very, very lucky to get you on the staff. That's what happens when you marry a St. Louis gal. You got to do what they say because St. Louis women are amazing, and that got you back to St. Louis.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for the kind words, JT. That was JT. I'm Matt. See ya. I had to do that last one for Gordo, you know?